This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, everyone, and hello, and welcome back to the New Books and French Studies podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bridget Wallace, your host. Today, I have the privilege and honor of interviewing Dr. Alyssa Goldstein Sippenwell. She is the author of The Abbé Grégoire and the French Revolution, The Making of Modern Universalism. It was University of California Press in 2005. This is a very beautifully written biography. It's based on newly discovered and previously overlooked material. And for the first time, we really gain access to the complexity of the Abbé's life and the role he played in the French Revolution. Dr. Sippenwell is a professor of history at California State University, San Marcos, and a specialist in French and Haitian history. In addition, she has written books about Haitian slave society, and she has written numerous articles on French and Haitian history. And I am very, very lucky since I study French and Haitian history. So this is really going to be wonderful. So welcome, Dr. Sippenwell. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me today, Bridget. And you can call me Alyssa.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, Alyssa, I just want to start and let you introduce yourself to the audience and talk to us about your research, especially about your two guiding principles in your personal life that kind of led you to this scholarship. Yes, I did read your blog.
I have to remember what were the two guiding principles, but my name is Alyssa Goldstein Sippenwell. I'm professor of history at California State University, San Marcos. I've taught there for 23 years here in Southern California after doing my doctorate at Stanford. And this book grows out of that doctorate. So for me, it was my first book, although University of California reissued it in paperback in 2021, because they decided that the story of an anti-racist priest who was a friend of Haitians was a story ahead of its time.
Yes, it very much was a story ahead of its time. We have actually been studying it in class and applying it actually to current events that's happening right now. Expand your French scholarship, your Haitian scholarship, and how you tied all of that together. And your two principles that you refer to are universalism and particularism.
Right. So the way that I got to this book, I was studying the Enlightenment as an undergraduate and looking at the Enlightenment and the French Revolution in kind of more old-fashioned, old-school ways. But I was really interested also in issues of identity in the modern state and multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. And so I started to think about also the way states treat minoritized groups, whether it's people minoritized because of their religion, their skin color, or their gender. And so while I was trying to decide what to work on, I thought, okay, I'd like to work on the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, but it would also be good to work on Jewish history. Jews were mistreated in the 18th century, but they were so-called emancipated by the French Revolution. I'd love to work on slavery and Black history. I'd love to work on gender. How can I do all of these things together? Right. And so the first dissertation topic that I tried, Bridget, was comparing debates in the French Revolution about Black people, Jews, and women. And my advisor was a little worried because he thought, it's a lovely question, but how are you going to rein that in terms of the archives? There's a huge amount of cartons and boxes on each of those topics. Right. And so while I was working on it and kind of spinning my wheels, my second advisor, Aaron Rodrigue, said, you really should do a biography of the Abbé Grégoire. And I said, the Abbé Grégoire, that white priest who wanted to convert Jews, why would I want to write a biography on him? But I gave the idea a try, and I spent 1 week doing nothing but reading Abbé Grégoire things. And at the end of the week, I realized he's totally right, because here's someone who was alive for 81 years, who lived before the French Revolution,
right,
and then stayed alive afterwards. Mm-hmm. And he worked on so many different topics, from being the so-called friend of Blacks and Jews to working on language politics. He also, unfortunately, was a misogynist general and didn't think women should be. And I thought, this is such an interesting topic and will allow me to work on all of these different issues. But coming back to universalism and particularism, I realized this was really a way to look at how has France and other modern nation states treated difference for the Abbé Grégoire and for the French Revolution. You could be included, you could be part of France, but you were supposed to give up your difference and regenerate yourself. And that just seemed so relevant to the challenge that I had in my life as the descendant of Ashkenazi Jews trying to hold on to my culture. And I had friends who were from lots of different cultures and figuring out, how do you code switch, or what are the things you do to hold on to your culture, but then be deemed okay in mainstream society? So it was a really good topic for me to be working on and thinking through those issues.
Yeah, I think his legacy of regeneration is so poignant right now. And it not only crosses into European country, states, and nations, it's also Latin America, Hispanic, because I'm TA, a Native American class. And this idea, you can be inclusive, but you have to look like me.
Right.
And when you were reading through his works and his memoirs and his decrees and letters that he wrote, did you get a sense of how he thought to deny someone's individuality for the greater good, that made sense? I've read your book a couple of times, because I told you it's part of my research. And I'm trying to understand how Robespierre, Grégoire, how the Committee of Public Safety, even the French Revolution, how did assimilating difference by whitewashing it make sense? I just don't understand that.
Yeah. So I'll start by saying I have very complicated feelings about Grégoire. Sometimes I'm like, go, tell them. And then other times, he drives me up the wall. And certainly as an opinionated woman, he probably would have not liked me in many ways. Although the fact that we share a commitment to helping people in Haiti and some other things, he might have thought I was okay sometimes. But you know, the thing about him is that he was a sincere Catholic, and he believed that other people who were not Catholic would not be saved. And so he thought that he was helping other people who were in the wrong. And so in that way, he's different from a more secular revolutionary like Robespierre, who I've also written about. And so Gregoire viewed his idea about the Jews, and this is one of the things that gives me very mixed feelings about him. And I certainly wanted to point out that he was not just a friend of the Jews, as many people say, that he criticized Judaism, he mocked Judaism. He said some really terrible things about the Jews of his time, early in his life. And so he just had this view that these groups, whether it was Jews or Black people in the Caribbean, had been mistreated, and this had caused them to be degenerate. And if you stopped mistreating them and allowed them to learn the beauties of Christianity, then they could be regenerated, then they could be perfect. So I have in the third chapter of my book, it's a little clunky, but I lay out kind of the landscape for talking about Jews in the 18th century. And I think it works for other groups. I say that there were people who were impossibilists. They said it was impossible to ever include the Jews in the nation because they were so other. These people were like modern anti-Semites and said Jews can't be loyal citizens. They're terrible people. So those people argued, can't ever include them. And Gregoire opposed them. He disagreed. And that was a lot of other Catholics. And they, you know, used terrible names for him. They called him a Jew lover or, you know, things like this. And so he said, no, they're, you know, they can become just like us if we stop mistreating them and if they stop believing their crazy beliefs. And he said, if we include them in the nation, then they can change. I point out, though, because sometimes people had said, oh, that's the progressive position in the 18th century. Right. And I say, no, there were people. So we've got the impossibilists who say you can't include them. You've got Gregoire, who I call a conditionalist. You can include them on condition that they're going to regenerate themselves, right? They'll show thanks by learning more about Christianity. And then there are people who are unconditionalists. And I would put Robespierre in that category and Jews themselves, who said the Declaration of the Rights of Man says all men are born and remain free and equal. We are men. And right now I'm talking about males, the issue. So we should be citizens. There doesn't need to be anything different. Men are citizens. We should be citizens. And of course, then you're going to have free Black people from the Caribbean, like Julien Raymond, who'll make the same argument. The Declaration of the Rights of Man says all men are born and remain free and equal. We are men. Therefore, so I did want to point out that Gregoire had this middle position, and he certainly was committed to including groups like Jews and enslaved people and free Blacks in the Caribbean, but he expected that they would reverse the so-called degeneration that they had developed as a result of racism and anti-Semitism wasn't the word then, but prejudice.
Well, I think the Jewish population faced the same obstacle that the free Black people of color faced. And it was this, what was the Ashkenazi Jews that they were kind of sidelined a little bit from the mainstream Jews. And for free persons of color, they sideline enslaved persons of color. And I don't know if, I know he kind of fought for the Say it again,
Ashkenazi.
Mm-hmm. Ashkenazi Jews.
There
he
we go.
Fought for them, but he didn't really fight for the slavery, even though in his one of his statements I read that he didn't believe in slavery because he was a member of this society for their means, but he still didn't fight for them to be part of the Declaration of the Rights of Citizens and Men. And can you explain that dynamic?
Yeah, the thing is that at that time, there was not really anyone in the National Assembly who was arguing for abolishing slavery in 1789.
Right.
You had these white abolitionists who were kind of gradual. And mm-hmm. also you had such fierce, entrenched opponents of equality. Mm-hmm. For free people of color in the Caribbean, that mm-hmm. they just said, okay, first, we're not going to talk about slavery. Let's just first talk about equality for free people of color.
Right.
And they started with that. And you have Robespierre, who does that at the beginning too, like Gregoire. And again, it's because of this belief that enslaved people had been degraded by slavery. So Gregoire had this belief that enslaved people were not inherently debased, but that the horrible treatment that they had faced and the way that the immoral, horrible enslavers treated them right. had, and they just weren't, quote unquote, ready for freedom yet. And so part of it is, did they really feel at the beginning that slavery was crucial? There were just so many issues that they were dealing with in 1789. Mm-hmm. Gregoire wrote in an early thing, there are people who care more about people of color 3,000 leagues across the sea than they do about Jews in their backyard.
I read that.
Yeah. I think it was once he started to meet free people of color, like mm-hmm. Julien Raymond, and mm-hmm. said, wow, here's a person. He's
right.
And I guess this is exactly like I've been arguing for the Jews. And then he pivoted and he became mm-hmm. a champion also of the free people of color.
Yeah. Yeah. He met Raymond. He met Auger too, Vincent right. Auger. He met him too. When talked about the enslaved, then there was a in the western side of Haiti, Monsieur Pinche, who was opposed OJ. He didn't want to accept the declaration just at face value. It was a group of free people of color who pushed back against Raymond, and OJ was there. That amazed me, but it made sense to me, because I'm always thinking, you think that because they're persons of color, so someone is saying that now you're equal among men, they're not just going to accept enlightenment language of liberty or citizenship just in front face, because like you said, they have built these relationships, albeit tenuous, they still wanted to keep them. Mm-hmm. And it was just the dynamics, because what I like about this book is that it has, from his beginning in his childhood and the way he studied his religion and the place from where he comes, to how he went from the curé and his different, how he went up the religious ladder, in other words. And because in the beginning, it looks like to me, he really just didn't care about his religion, you uh-huh. know, at all. He just uh-huh. wanted, he was just there to get all the privileges that he could get and to be just debaseful as he wanted to be. So what was his flip? What I know it was when he was a curé at Ebermal. Mm-hmm. Was that the point? Was that the point of origin that caused him all of a sudden to start to pull everything together and flip?
I'm going to go back for 1 second, just if I can. I do mm-hmm. want to say that even though he wasn't arguing for ending slavery per se, he mm-hmm. still was really fiery in calling out enslavers and saying mm-hmm. that this needed to end. There's a speech that he gave. I was just looking on my bookshelf, but I can't mm-hmm. grab it quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's in a collection by David Geggis, The French Revolution, a documentary history. And mm-hmm. there's a speech that he gives where he basically tells off enslavers. It's from 1790 or 1791.
Okay.
And he says, basically, Like eat grass and be just, meaning like give up sugar. You don't need it for slavery. It's better if you're poor and you're not enslaving people. And he got so much hate from this. From people who said like, you know, want to compare it to like AOC or something even more where he gets demonized for being someone who wants to just, you know, overthrow the colonial system. So I do want to, again, I told you I have a mixed relationship with him.
I think critical,
but it's important to keep that too. Okay. So how does he get to Jews and how does he get to talking about people of color? So it's not simply that he just had this great social conscience and wanted to help people. And I was really struck by this, Bridget, as I reread the book in preparation to talk to you today, because I remember, I mean, I wrote it, and I remember, but I've been working on other things. So there's certain elements that didn't stick in my mind as much. And I just was struck again to remember how ambitious he was. He was a guy from the countryside. A lot of priests came from wealthy families. Maybe the priest was the third son in the family, but he was a very rare scholarship kid who became a priest. And he was really smart. And so he had all kinds of ambitions and he wanted to become famous like a lot of young men in the 18th century. And so he did what a lot of them did, was to enter essay contests sponsored by royal academies and hope you'd win. And then all the famous people would know about you. That was a really a way to like, you know, make it. So the first contest he entered, it might not have been the first, but he enters a poetry contest. Really sappy thing that later he was embarrassed about. As a priest, he said, you shouldn't have been using all of this romantic language. But he enters different contests, and then he enters one that was kind of, again, an anti-Jewish premise. How do we save peasants from Jewish usury?
Yes.
He enters that one. And then later, the Royal Academy of Metz has a contest in 1785. How can we make the Jews of France more useful and more happy? And I've argued that the entry, the famous entry that the Abbé Grégoire puts in, was a revision of the old one from the other contest. And so he kind of dusts it off and revises it. And there, although that's famous as an entry in which he wanted to help Jews, there's really a lot of critical stuff in there where he basically seems to think that his peasants are suffering under Jewish usury and the Jewish religion is stupid. And at first, the Academy decides that no one won. They ask people to redo it. And at that point, Grégoire thinks, oh, I really want to win this contest. And he starts to meet some Jews. He finds some Jews to talk to. And then he starts to feel a little bad. And he puts in some footnotes apologizing to new friends. But it you know, when you meet other people and you've had ideas about them, I think it starts to change you. And even though Grégoire still had this idea, okay, their religion is stupid, they need to convert to Christianity, he started to recognize that they were real people. And he starts to argue for including them as equal citizens. And then, as I said, he meets Julien Raymond, and then he decides, and you know, he really was courageous. Even though I'm talking about him as being ambitious, he really, you know, we say today, I can say this on NBN, he did not give a F. He just said, I'm going to argue for these groups, and if people want to say nasty things about me, it doesn't matter, because I think this is right.
Yeah, now, if I learned anything from your writing of him, that's what I learned. I learned that I felt that he was consistent to himself. I felt that he went out when he finally got to Emma Merrill and got the cure and was at the parish. And you talk about how he started to help his parishioners, how he was working with the peasants and the rural farmers and how he was helping them. I was reading about how he was a person that soaked up knowledge like a sponge. You talk about in his relationship about languages, how that came about, Oberlin, language transforming a countryside. We watched a movie, kind of sort of a satire about Gregoire, but we could see how he it's like he will place himself in situations in his mind to try to think that he's going to get things done. Ridicule, that's what we watched.
Okay.
But throughout the work, every place, every space that he entered, he learned something from it. And then he took that knowledge and created a bigger knowledge. Does that make sense to you?
He was always learning and evolving. And I think sometimes he was self-righteous.
Oh yeah, I think definitely there's a little narcissism in here. He thought he was right, definitely. But one of the things that you said about him is the fact that he didn't believe that Paris really had a traditional language, traditional Christian religion, that he just thought it was a religion based on whatever the wind swept in at the time. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Definitely, he certainly thought that there were a lot of people who were not practicing, and so even in the National Assembly, he's encountering a lot of people who we thought were not faithful. And then later in his life, one of his last big works was called The History of Religious Sects, Histoire des Sectes Religieuses. And it really is an effort for him to argue that everyone else is wrong on religion, but they can still embrace the one true faith, which is a kind of enlightened Christianity. He did think that the kind of Catholicism that was practiced by the bishops at his time was not really the religion of Jesus. So he was part of a movement that was trying to bring the religion back to its origins and really help the poor more, and not be something where you had wealthy bishops enjoying the tithes of their parishioners to live in big palaces.
That and that was a problem in the French Revolution, this idea of overwhelming Catholic religion. Being a former African American Catholic, I can understand that completely. That's why I'm not there now. But anyway, but here's my thing though. So he became a deputy within the French Revolution, became a member of the Committee of Public Safety. Did he do that because he felt that his regeneration ideology, he could best push it out from that space? Because when you went there, I was a little shocked. I didn't think that I thought he was going to stay where he was at and just kind of go up the parishioner ladder. So was it because the French Revolution, with this idea of constitutional cleric versus just direct religious cleric, is that he took this opportunity to try to push everything that was inside of him that he wanted to push out? Is that why he made that transition?
So again, he was really idealistic and ambitious. So when there were elections to send people to the National Assembly as representative of the clerics, he wanted to run. And he also, it was part of a revolt against the bishops that this should be this true church, WWJD, right? Gregoire didn't have hashtags, but to make it a church that was more committed to the poor. And so he was really happy to get elected. And then he shows up in Paris, and the bishops are just not wanting to do the things that the Third Estate wanted. And Gregoire is like, let me in there. And he became an ally with the Third Estate and is trying to argue that the rest of the clergy, and it was scandalous. I quote in the book a letter from someone back home who heard that Gregoire was calling out his bishop, which was totally against the hierarchy. And people were scandalized, but Gregoire liked this idea that you didn't just have to be deferential to powerful people and that you could remake society. So he just starts becoming more and more important. And as I said, just like Robespierre, he was a really fiery orator. And when Gregoire wanted to go off on something, I mean, I look at some of these sentences he wrote were just that, and it's amazing. He just was such a lively speaker. And so he eventually, not the Committee of Public Safety, but the Committee of Public Instruction, he gets on that. And that's going to be a way to totally revamp education and the way people are brought up in France. And he loved that committee.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow. So let's go back a little bit to this idea of biography, because we have their memoirs, diaries, letters that people have written about them. Couple of questions. And you talked about this idea of writing a biography, that you had to grapple with that. Didn't want to put out a passé type biography. You know, they're out here a mile a minute. But when you went through the archives of him, how did they speak to you for you to speak for him in this work?
Well, I don't want to say I speak for him, because sometimes I'm highlighting, you know, things that he wouldn't have liked, and places where maybe he didn't step up as he should. But yes, I went to graduate school in the 90s. We were all reading Foucault and other things, and doing a biography of a dead white man, a dead white Christian man, just seemed like a terrible thing, especially because I was interested. I thought about writing an intellectual biography of Julien Raymond or some other.
Wow.
Yeah. I like it when people are answering back, whether it's Jewish intellectuals or Mary Wollstonecraft talking to Rousseau. Mm-hmm. And I realized, okay, sometimes you have to, you know, take it to the house or whatever. I've got to look at Gregoire, this famous guy, to think about these issues, to think about how France treated difference. And I just, you know, as I was reading, I was like, some of these things I love, some of these things I love to hate. Mm-hmm. And it just, I thought, you know, I'm having a lot of fun reading this guy. And again, sometimes things are resonating and sometimes things I didn't like at all. Mm-hmm. So I realized that if I really wanted to deal with these big issues, and I had so many big issues, I went through graduate school and my undergraduate career. What's the relationship of the Enlightenment to the French Revolution? Why did the French Revolution happen? Why did the French Revolution radicalize from this nice, harmonious 1789 to the revolutionaries turning on each other? Why did the revolution fail? What happens to revolutionary idealism afterwards? These were all really, what's the relationship between revolutionary ideology about people freeing themselves, and then that France has this so-called civilizing mission where they're going to invade people for their own good? And I realized, wow, people have been telling me I need to settle down and pick one thing to work on.
But they tell you that too?
Oh, yes. Yes, Bridget. I remember a staff person on campus who said, you really need to just pick one of these things. And I saw Gregoire and it was like a Peter Pan topic. I wouldn't have to grow up. I could keep working on all of these things. And so the way I organized the biography, it's chronological.
Yeah.
The first part looks at his youth before the revolution. The second part looks at the revolution. And the third part looks at what happens after the revolution until 1831. But each section tackles big issues. So the first section, what's the relationship of the Enlightenment to the French Revolution? And was the Enlightenment really anti-religious? That's kind of the image we have from Voltaire, that the Enlightenment attacked the church. And so to discover you have lots of young priests like Gregoire who were involved in Enlightenment institutions and embraced Enlightenment ideas was something that was new. And then the second part, I could look more at revolutionary universalism and the way that it included people, but expected that they would change and give up their difference. And then the last section looks at this paradox of a revolution that gives people around the world, right? You've got Ho Chi Minh, Aimé Césaire, lots of people citing the Declaration of the Rights of Man to argue that they should have rights. And at the same time, this ideology that Gregoire, I think that was one of his biggest impacts, helps shape this idea of including people, but regenerating them. That also helped justify colonialism as the French took over other places. So I think the revolution had a much more mixed legacy. Yeah, so that's some of the reasons that I decided to do biography, but I tried to do it differently and not just celebrate my great white hero, but also point out areas where he'd been inconsistent.
I think Gregoire's static about being admitted into the pantheon actually symbolizes the static of the French Revolution. This mixed idea that was it the French Revolution that brought the philosophies and the idealism of the Enlightenment to the forefront? Was it this universal umbrella that everybody could stand under and push for whatever distinctive or succinctive freedoms and equality you were looking for? For me, it has always been, is France this space of liberty, fraternity, and equality? I have always, that's the question. That's how I got to this place right here. But I think when you write about this idea, this pantheonization of Gregoire in the epilogue, I think that pulls together everything that you have been talking about. It shows France's conundrum, especially how the Jewish nation started to turn against him, how people in Haiti started to turn against him. It was three things. There it is. So in Elevating the Abbey, the government hoped to do three things. That's what you wrote on 224. That's what you wrote. The first one you said is that the revolution, people argued that the revolution had been bloodthirsty and was not worth celebrating. The Gregoire represented a peaceable and non-regidal alternative to the revolution of Robespierre. Then the second one you say is that after decades of blows to French national identity from revelations about Vichy and other debilitating losses of France empire, Gregoire would help vindicate France by depicting that it was a source of universalistic ideas. And then the third one, I think that was the second and third one that you had wrote, and that his remains were accompanied along the Rue Soufflé by a traditional clad woman from a Senegalese island of Gori. And that his honor would reconcile a church and a republic. That's a powerful paragraph.
Thank you. Yeah, and I really like the way you stated that, Bridget. So really, again, with the biography, I was trying to get at this question you asked, is France the land of liberty? And with Gregoire, you could really see that. On the one hand, they were putting him in the Pantheon in 1989 during the bicentennial, 200 years of the revolution. The I'll just say for listeners who might not know, the French government picked three revolutionaries to put in. And again, it's a big deal. The Abbé Gregoire, as you were quoting from me, is not bloodthirsty Robespierre, although I have other thoughts on Robespierre that I've written recently, but, you know, peaceful, anti-racist guy who is also not against the church. And so he's this symbol of unity for the country and of the fact that it's the land of liberty. And the fact that there was still a lot of controversy shows you that this idea that France is the land of liberty is not so simple. And I think that some biographers, so the last chapter of my book, the epilogue, as you said, looks at debates about Gregoire. And some biographers wouldn't have included that because the point of a biography, they might think, is to show what someone's life was really like. But for me, the debates about him get to this issue of his ideas about difference and the ideas that the French Revolution adopted, were they good or not? And he's kind of a flashpoint. And when I was rereading the book yesterday, Bridget, I got chills when I read the paragraph about the Nazis knocking his statue down when they invaded Lunéville in World War II. That was just a reminder to me that as much as I might criticize aspects of him, the fact that he's an anti-racist symbol and even argued for helping the Jews at all was disgusting. And of course, there are still people today in the world who have those same feelings and would do the same thing again to people that they see as anti-racist. They think being anti-racism is something bad. So yeah. I wanted to include all of these debates to think about this issue that I end with at the end. France still has not figured out how to deal with difference because of this expectation that if people are French, that they should be the same. And you see that today in France in the demonization of immigrants and controversies over Muslim women wearing the veil, that this is somehow anti-French. And it's something that France still has not resolved, but of course it's not only the French.
No, it was not just the French. And I read that section about the Nazis when he was in the Loire Valley knocking down, evading his sanctuary. And I cried, you know, being African-American and watching what's going on now where we live, you know, this idea of symbolism and destroying, you think you can destroy symbols and people and ideas by knocking down something that's concrete, but you don't knock down the ideal, you don't knock down the policy, because the policy is something that's mental and ingrained in the person. I like the biography because of your epilogue, because of the fact a traditional biography, and you're right, it's all good. It's all good. And no one is all good. And I like the fact that as much as his regeneration ideology had this legacy, because it has a legacy, as much as it had a legacy, it had thorns in his legacy, but you weren't afraid to talk about those thorns. And those are the thorns that we need to talk about, because a legacy is only as good as the interaction and as the thought process that a person coming behind is going to put to it. It's just like Martin Luther King. His legacy is good because people still continually can debate it. It has controversy, but it provides this space of thought. It provides this space of reflection. And I think the one thing that I appreciate about the Abbey is that he gives us a space of reflection. He gives this idea of balance. We've been reading Sewell's article about what is a historical event. And my issue is, what is a historical person? What is a historical person? Is a historical person a one that's going to do something in within their time frame, but does that something fly down to different periods? As he says, a historical event, he does it in a particular space, but it can be applied to go down the centuries, go back to, and he talked about the French Revolution, the storming of the Bastille, actually. So we can look at Gregoire's regeneration. It applied to World War I, World War II, not only France, but to Africa, to India, to China, even to, you know, some parts of the United States. So what is a historical person? And if we look at a person like that, then we have to be able to look at the totality of the person. And you do a really, really good job of helping us look at the totalitary one person. Can you talk to me, though, a little bit? Because I know you've read it, his D-lecture to the Free People of Color.
Can I just go back for a moment? What you just said was very, very rich. And yes, I tried to talk about the thorns. And I'll tell you that there were people in France And then maybe senior white gatekeepers in the field here who thought I was too hard on him. They said, oh, come on. Back then in his time, he was the most anti-racist. And I tried to show sometimes he wasn't, right? When, right, because Jews and free people of color were also men of his time, and they argued with him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worthwhile to look at white anti-racists and to talk about their limitations sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I have limitations also, and it's worth highlighting them. I tried as much as I could to be nuanced in how I approached him and to give him his due, but then also to highlight areas where he maybe didn't live up to his own principles. He argued against racism, and occasionally he came up with a racist idea, like if whites and Black people married, that the new people would be stronger.
Yeah, and enlightening the race. Yeah, enlightening color of the race. Yeah.
And so I think that now this idea of criticizing someone like that in 22 is more accepted. And I think that's one reason that the book came out. But there were people who said, oh, you're a politically correct American. You're criticizing him, but people at the time didn't. So that's one reason, as a deeply contextual intellectual historian, I tried to show, but there were people at the time who did, and people in the 20s and in the 30s. And it's not just me doing this in 2005. Okay. So you're asking me which books? He wrote 300 of them. So
his letter to free people of color that he read in the National Assembly, the De La Lettre that he wrote, Arthur Schomburg had built the Schomburg Center around.
Okay, so you might mean De La Littérature des Nègres, which is from 1808. And so, that's a really important book. In it, okay, so Gregoire goes through the French Revolution. He's there when slavery is not there in person, but as slavery is abolished. And he is an abolitionist. And then in 1802, Napoleon decides to reinstate slavery.
Right.
And Gregoire is the senator. And apparently Gregoire told Napoleon to his face, if I wasn't looking at you, I'd know that you were white from the way that you're talking. And he disagreed with this sharply. Mm-hmm. And, but there was censorship as the Napoleonic regime went on. And so he couldn't publish a book that says Napoleon sucks or why Napoleon was wrong about slavery. So he publishes a book that's called On the Literature, if I use a more modern word, of Black people.
That's what it's called.
Yeah, so it's in 1808. And against not just Napoleon, but Thomas Jefferson and other people who were racist at the time, he says, you say that Black people are inferior and that this is biological. Mm-hmm. How can this be? I'm going to lay out for you the literature of lots of African descended people, whether he's talking about Phyllis Wheatley or Olato Equiano or other people. And again, he's specifically, how can we then look at Jefferson, who says that they're inferior, when we see all of these examples? So really the purpose of that was to lay out intellectual achievements of people of African descent and to argue, to use that to argue that slavery is wrong. And that book has been really meaningful. Because remember, again, I'm interested in the legacy and how people have seen Gregoire. So for African-Americans in the Harlem Renaissance, there were a lot of people who liked Gregoire. Arturo Schomburg was one of them. And he was a Caribbean immigrant from Puerto Rico. And he was working on Wall Street as a mail clerk. And he used the money that he saved up to try to buy from rare booksellers all of these books from 18th century Black writers. and to make a collection. And that eventually became the Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. But the basis for that, when he was looking around, he had Gregoire's book so he could check people off.
And check make people sure off and find their works. Oh, yeah. Wow. That is wonderful, because I'm actually headed there next month for research. Yeah, I'm headed there. I'm so excited. Wow. You tie him in to so many different spaces. I'm a fan of Mark Bloch, and he would be proud, because Mark Bloch says that history is nothing but the human interaction within the spaces that each interaction defines. And you place Gregoire in so many different spaces, but they're not wasted spaces. Does that make sense? They're not wasted spaces. They're very intentional space. I looked at his life after the Third Republic, and he was still, now he's up against the religion, up against Catholicism, but still believing, though, that his central value system is still intact, and that it's always going to be intact, and that politicians and institutions are just grabbing at what they can grab to define themselves instead of letting the value and the moral define them. Is that like a holdover from?
Yeah, well, one of the things that just has really struck me reading this book again as I'm older than I was. I was in my 20s and in my 30s when I did this dissertation in the book, and I'm 52 now. So I was reading the book, and I realized Gregoire was 52 when Napoleon reinstated slavery. And I understand completely how he felt. Here he'd just been through this movement, and it was exhilarating, and they were fighting for equality, and all the forces who were against equality had been defeated, and they created a new society. And then all of a sudden,
here he comes.
Like, it's all changing, and then there's a king again. And he can't believe that fellow Frenchmen are sitting still while they've lost democracy, which they just won. And so I really feel that there were definitely things he changed over the course of his life. But he had a real belief that there shouldn't be a king, that people should rule themselves, and that he did not change, 1802 to 1831. And that's one reason he was kind of people laugh when I make analogies, but in some ways he's like Bernie Sanders. He's the cool old guy that the young people are looking to.
That's a good analogy.
That guy is like us. You know, the other old people, they're not cool, they're backwards, but he's like us. And you have, like, he's not even running for election, and they write him in as a candidate in the late 1810s for the Senate. And the Senate said, no, we're not letting Gregoire be seated. they called him a regicide and said he'd voted to kill the king. But yeah, he really stood for something, and that was trying to get a republic back.
Yeah, he did. So tell us, as we coming to the end, what are you doing now? What is your research about now? Where are you headed? And can I be your good friend?
That would be lovely. So my second book was about Haitian history, and I wrote it after the earthquake. Mm-hmm. And obviously from this book, you see I was interested in Haiti, and I wrote about the memory of the Haitian Revolution. Mm-hmm. But when the earthquake happened, I was watching people on TV in 2010, and they were so ignorant about Haiti, and they knew so little, that I realized I needed to pivot. Even though I still work on France, I needed to write a book putting together Haitian history from the 18th century to the present, so people could understand how the international community had mistreated Haiti. Okay. So again, maybe that's something the Abbé Gregoire would have liked, that I was standing up for Haiti. But one of the things that I've always been interested in, and this grows out of the epilogue also, is depictions and representations. And so how Haitians and the Haitian Revolution have been depicted in film has been something I'm interested in. And then a student told me about a video game about slave resistance in colonial Haiti, Saint-Domingue. And I couldn't believe that this existed. And I explored it. a video game. And so I ended up, my most recent book, which came out last year from Mississippi, is called Slave Revolt on Screen, The Haitian Revolution in Film and Video Games. And I looked at the ways that the Haitian Revolution has been depicted and the different ways that white Europeans and Americans have depicted the revolution compared to Haitians and other people. And part of that is also I'm trying to amplify the idea that Haitians should be able to tell their own history, which, right, as a principle is something obvious, but given the poverty that has been imposed on Haitians for a variety of factors, it's the filmmaking capital is in Hollywood and Paris. So you've right. got Americans and French people who are telling this story on screen. Right. So I really try in that book to amplify the work that Haitians are doing and to get average viewers to try to seek out films by Haitians. But it's also one of the very first books by a historian about historical video games and what makes something a good video game. So that's what I've been working on. And I think I'm going to keep working in that area for a little while.
That sounds wonderful. I never would have thought a video game about the Haitian Revolution. That just doesn't...
I was shocked when the students told me. And Bridget, I'll send you the trailers afterwards. But I also found that one of my favorite Caribbean writers, Patrick Chamoiseau, who looks at the memory of slavery today and its legacy, he had worked on a video game. Two of them, actually, in the late 1980s. Even though this was not discussed in scholarship. So having a chance to look at the Slave Revolt video games that he developed with the first Black woman game developer, Muriel Tramy, was really amazing. So I have a whole chapter about their games.
Okay, now I've got to get the books. Okay, yes.
And there's a new Books Network interview on that book that people can listen to also.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I definitely will have to read that book because I never would have thought about that. Let me ask you a quick question before I let you go. Talk to me a little bit. Besides his association with Raymond, did he associate with any other free people of color, or was Raymond the only one?
No, I think that people would come to see him in Paris, and they would come to see him for many years. And he also was writing a lot of letters to Haitians. So that was something really wonderful to be able to find in the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal in Paris, was his correspondence with Haitians.
Okay. All right. Now look, it was so wonderful talking to you. You are magnificent. Your work is just dynamic. It's really dynamic. And I can just see your enthusiasm when you just talk about this. You are so passionate about this work. I hope you'll come again in another time to talk with us. And everyone have a great day. Everyone have a great day. And this is Bridget Wallace and the New Books French Studies Network. Thank you.